if you're on the, you know, the other side of that lie, you know, if you know, I just got my hair cut, I haven't really, and
yeah.
And
so yeah, I was going to say, Manny, that if you had, then you'd be ripped off.
And I asked you about it, and you said something like that, and it upset me. Would I prefer to be lied to? The other way round.
Yeah.
You know.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Yeah. Because everybody always says, oh, you know, I want the truth. I want people to be truthful to me. But I think, do you really? Do you really want people to be truthful to you? Do you remember there was an episode? You're a Buffy viewer, haven't you?
I'm not, actually, no. I'm not. Yeah, I know you were.
I'm sorry, but we can no longer be friends, I'm afraid, Danny. But there was an episode where something happened. You know, the MacGuffin was that she'd got splashed with demon blood of some sort or another. And it gave her telepathic powers, slowly but surely. But, I mean, only receptive, so you couldn't actually communicate. And it almost drove her mad because, you know, everywhere you went, you could hear what everybody was thinking. The truth was out there. So, you know, what people thought about you, what people thought about their environment, what people thought about themselves, you know, what they were planning to do, what, you know, all that kind of stuff was just like an open book. And it's just kind of, nobody wants that. You know, nobody wants the pure, unalloyed truth just thrown at them.
One of the few things I liked about that Star Trek Picard series was the Romulan who was you know, from Lord of the Rings, that guy. And this concept of absolute candor.
Absolute candor, yeah.
I like that, and we got that going in our house to a certain extent, actually. A lot of truth telling, and to each other, like you're putting on a bit too much weight, or something like that, you know. Yeah. And I think I appreciate that more.
Really?
I think I do appreciate that more, yeah.
But I suppose that depends where you're... Again, it depends. You've got to kind of... All of these things are kind of, you know, are mitigated in some way, because it depends how it's said, and it depends where you stand. I mean, if you have a... If you have, like, body issues, genuinely have kind of, you know, body image issues... And somebody comes up to you and say, "My God, Dan, you're fat." True. Well, it's not true because you're not. But I mean, that might be a true thing. But is it an ethically right thing to say? Because I mean, you know, it could cause you all. I mean, Kant would say, "Yeah, it comes to." I mean, you know, in a sense, be honest and just say, "Yep, absolutely." I mean, you might. I think Kant would probably be smart enough to say, "You know, just come out and say you're fat." But then again,
but you might have body issues because someone, you know, pussyfooted around.
Never told
and
you
said,
the truth.
You know, said you weren't. You know, said you weren't putting on weight, and then, this kind of thing.
But you see, I mean, Bentham, obviously, I mean, Bentham would say, well, you know, the greatest happiness would be just to lie to people about that and just say, okay, you are fat, but I'm not going to tell you that because it's going to make you miserable, and, you know, it'll stop you eating pies and drinking beer. Yeah. So I'm just going to say, well, the greatest happiness for you is for me to say, man, looking good. Looking good. Another pint? Yeah.
Again, we go down the path of consequences, don't we?
Yes. Yeah. So this is what you're trying. I mean, I suppose a part of it is kind of what you want to achieve and what you're trying to achieve by your ethic. Are you trying to make yourself happy? Are you trying to make other people happy? Have you taken that kind of a Bentham approach? I mean, obviously, he says, the greatest happiness for the greatest number. Mm. Are you trying to avoid unhappiness? For particular groups, it might both be, you know, or my tribe, my particular group. I want to make sure they're happy and not everybody else. You know, where does your ethic rest? What is it you're trying to achieve?
That's the biggest problem, isn't it? It's the idea that you can make everybody happy. I remember there's a comedian, what's his name? Bill Hicks.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Bill Hicks, and it was actually it's quite rare. It's like interview after like a gig he did in some bar, and someone was not happy with the kind of material he was doing. It was like, you know, too much swearing or, you know, too much taboo subjects, and they gave him the classic line, "Why can't you do something that will, you know, make everybody?" You know, they can appeal to everybody.
Yeah, everybody can laugh at that. Yeah,
and he said. And he's like, and perfect answer was, what a burden. No one's ever accomplished that.
No.
You know, that is what you have to become a superhuman.
Yeah. And that's perhaps why that's perhaps why, you know, Cantor in a way is so attractive, because he's saying, well, you know, I'm not trying, you know, we're not trying to differentiate different kinds of human beings and different kind of situations and trying to kind of get our head around all the kind of complexities. We just set up a set law, a set menu. It's like going for a meal, you know. And I'm dreadful at this. If I go out for a meal, not that I've done that much recently, but if you go out for a meal, you know, the bigger the menu, the more stressed out I become, because I'm looking through the menu. So, well, I could have that, but I could also have that. Actually, that looks quite nice, but I mean, is that going to upset my stomach? Is there going to be enough on that one? And you're kind of going through all this stuff. Is this kind of healthy? Is this not healthy? I don't know. Whereas if you go to a menu and there's just like three things on it, much easier for you to say, actually, you know, I'm picking that one. And it just makes it more straight. Maybe Cantor's saying that. Maybe Cantor's saying that, you know, you give somebody too big a menu and you'll never choose anything off the menu. And then when you do, you'll want the thing the other person's been served up anyway.
Well, like there's this documentary called, I think it's called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. It's about a sushi restaurant in Tokyo. You know, it's like Michelin stars and all that. And you go there is no menu. He gives you what he's making that day, or what he thinks you're going to like.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's always great.
Yeah,
because you know, it's perfection.
Yeah.
I like that kind of dictatorial method of, this is what you're having to eat, whether you like it or not. You know?
When you talk to people who are kind of running households where and they're doing the cooking, for example, for a family that are really kind of awkward, and it's kind of, oh yeah, well, you know, so and so, he did, you know, basically like meat and potatoes, and then, you know, my daughter has decided she wants to become vegan, and you know, my son won't eat dairy products or fish and whatever, and you know, I've just got to cook, you know, three different meals for all of them, or try and come up with a meal that will satisfy all of these people. And it's like, you know, it's like
Mr. Ford.
Yeah, Mr. Ford. What's his first name? I've forgotten his name now. That's annoying, isn't it? Anyway, yeah, Mr. Ford, you know, of Ford cars. One famous quote that I'm familiar with is that, you know, you can have the Model T Ford in whatever colour you like, as long as it's black.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just, yeah, sometimes it's simplicity there, because you can go in and you can say, yeah, I'm having that car there, and you go out with it. And I think, you know, because, with an ethic, in some ways, you know, I don't know whether, you know, should it, the more tortuous an ethic, then it could be argued, the more tortuous the ethical process, the less chance there is of you actually acting ethically, because you become incapacitated, you become paralysed for fear of doing the wrong thing or not thinking the right thing. Whereas you say, okay, I'm not going to lie, I'm not going to kill, I'm not going to cheat, I'm not going to do that under any circumstance, and then, you know, I will deal with the consequences of that as they come across, and deal with them according to the same ethical system. I won't lie, I won't cheat, and there's a consistency there. And you learn to you create a life around that, and that may well overlap with a little Wittgenstein, because it may well be that, you know, you have to do that within the confines of a certain language game, so you don't necessarily call somebody fat. You have to sort of say, yeah, perhaps you know, you need to get a little bit more exercise, or, you know, maybe your diet could change. You'd have to be abusive and hurtful about these things. But whereas with Bentham, kind of anything goes, and, you know, what happens to kind of make people happy at the moment. I mean, you know, happy at the moment. 6 months down the line, something else might make them happy.
Well, he was big on, you know, penal reform. He had the Panopticon and all that. But it's almost, you know, about looking at humans like animals, isn't it? And about getting them to do what you want, rather than looking at the motivation. Looking at the the individual consciousness, conscience, and the motivation, which is probably more Kantian, isn't it? I forgot. I was going to say something about. Yeah, there is something in the human nature as well, isn't there, to upset the apple cart? And I know it's something in me. I have a little bit of punk in me. I always think about it. You know, like you could listen to, you know, classical music or. But it's nothing like, you know, just hear a bit of noise.
Yeah.
And
you've been getting your jazz on recently, haven't you?
Jazz, yeah. I found it fascinating. I think I approached it more in a kind of historical way. If you ever get a chance to look at the history of how jazz developed and how these lots of different things came in. Mm. Like, you know, it was military bands, it was slave culture, yeah. It was, you know, immigrants having to live together, mm. and this beautiful thing emerging. But I was going to say, yeah, so have you ever tried this thing, talking about, like, making food and making sure everyone's happy with food? Planning meals in advance. We did this for a while. Let's do it, because then you can plan what you're going to buy, and you can kind of budget for that.
Mm.
And I set up using like Google Calendar.
Oh wow!
You know, yeah, a month's worth of meals. Some of them repeated, some of them not.
What happens to you, Danny?
No, let me finish the story, because it was a chance to let's try this. I get into these things like I like you know, looking at Excel formulas and going in like technical stuff.
Oh man,
it comes from liking like technology.
Mm.
You know, this is exciting. Let's see if we can do it. And then you get into that kind of Jurassic Park thing of you didn't think about, you know, whether you should. anyway, so that lasted for a while. And then we just got, you know, and then we got to the stage, oh, it's Tuesday. Oh, it's, you know, spaghetti bolognese. Oh, I don't want to eat that.
Yeah, but it says so. On the chart. Yeah.
It says so. You know, if we start straying from this.
Yeah, but you know you are. You see, ooh. You know, yeah, you can shop. You can shop effectively. Yeah. You know where you are. Yeah.
Let me end up deleting it all, by the way.
Really?
Because it's. Yeah. I don't want to eat that. No, I don't want to eat that. Well, Annie. let's throw it out Annie. The window. Dogs and cats
living together.
Yeah.
Mass hysteria. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Because you kind of think to yourself, okay, well, why did we do that? Well, you know, okay, we did that because, you know, we like to eat, but we also kind of, you know, we're busy people, so we can't be incapacitated by the kind of the quest for food.
Or the annoyance of trying to think what we're going to eat tonight.
So you want to eat, and you want to eat interesting stuff, and you want to kind of eat healthy stuff and stuff, and you think, well, I can't leave it till the last minute to make a judgment on this. And that's, in a sense, that's why there's an ethic. That's why we're concerned with ethics at all, because we can't function in the world from first principles. Every time we encounter an ethical issue, it can't be, oh gosh, you know, I'm in a situation now. I have now got to trot out and lay out all the ethical kind of implications, because, you know, you'd just be stood there while the world was going on around you. We tend to make ethical decisions based on an ethical system that we've already kind of put in place, and it may well be kind of a bit rickety. But, you know, if I go into a room and I see, like, you know, somebody's left their phone on the table, I don't have to think to myself, oh, well, should I steal that? Is it better than my phone? You know, I don't think that, because I've already have a kind of an intuitive ethic built up over years that says you don't do that. That's beyond the pale. It's unacceptable. So, you know, having that kind of almost like that kind of ethical spreadsheet in the background of your mind is a way of helping us to kind of continue to act ethically in the world without having to kind of, you know, work out for every occasion. So I can understand Bentham's attempt to say we've got to come up with a calculus. If we can come up with a kind of like a spreadsheet, a calculus for this, then it should be fairly easy in any situation not to be kind of incapacitated, not to be kind of held up. We can just kind of say, yeah, that's what we're going to do. That's what we're going to do, because that's how the calculus works. I kind of understand his motivation.
It occurs to me that, like the early Christian philosophers who come up with a proof for existence of God, they weren't trying to convince themselves.
No, they weren't.
They're trying to convince everybody else.
Mm.
Maybe, you know, coming at this like, oh, well, I know that I'm not going to steal. I know that, you know, a philosopher might think, oh, I'm not going to steal, but I need to convince everybody else that it's a bad thing. And then you work on this structure. It occurs to me that that's kind of what's happening.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I think we have in our modern world a kind of loss of faith in a kind of individual morality. So we've got all these kind of checks and balances. I was thinking about that, you know, I wouldn't, even if you wanted to steal that phone, you wouldn't, because that phone might have an app on it that will take your picture.
Yes.
It's the fear now. It's not the actual It's not that, I won't take that because it's morally wrong. It's the fear that I might get caught.
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And that's, I mean, and that's, I think you see more of that in utilitarianism than you do necessarily in Kant. Because I think in kind of Bentham and the utilitarians, there's much more of an overlap between ethics and law. As you're saying, you know Bentham's saying, you know, it has to be, in a sense, ethics has to be backed up by law. You have to be doing what's right, is what society has decided, and you can't appeal to anything beyond that. You can't have a get out of jail free card by saying, oh yeah, the law says this, but you know, I can do this because, you know, God tells me I'm allowed to do it, or because, you know, my conscience tells me. No, you obey the you know, the rule of law established by the society. If you're going to work within that societal narrative, I think it was in the Nixon Frost interviews. Do you remember the Nixon Frost interviews?
Yeah,
or you heard on.
It was a good film.
Yes, yeah, with. Oh, what's his name as Frost?
Sheen.
Michael Sheen. Yeah, brilliant, absolutely brilliant. In the Nixon Frost interviews, it becomes patently obvious fairly early on that Nixon didn't. I mean, he said, "I am not a crook." He didn't see himself as being unethical.
Mm.
So it wasn't, you know, it wasn't kind of, oh, I've done a bad thing. Oh my God, I've done a bad thing. Oh, you know, what a bad man. It's what he was concerned about is he got caught. You know, he got caught, and it was a legal ramifications. Okay, they found me, they got me on that kind of legal thing here, and that's it. Not, you know, I've disobeyed the any kind of ethical standard. And I think that's a lot, and I think this is probably what utilitarianism kind of sees as. It might not be ideal, but sees as basically how ethics works, is that people will work up to the, you know, people will function up to the limits of the law.
Yeah.
So they'll push it. They'll just say, okay, well, it's like, you know, people kind of, you know, sort of offshore banking and you know, people getting involved in kind of like tax avoidance and all that kind of stuff, tax evasion. And it's kind of, well, you know, it's not illegal, so I'm a good guy. It might not be illegal, but it's goddamn immoral. You know, you're not actually putting any money into a society, but you're still taking it out. So that seems to me to be immoral on whatever, you know, model of morality I'm using. But as far as they're concerned, no, I'm not breaking the law. It's fine.
Mm. Well, they go further, don't they? Because they kind of remould the moral law. Some of these people, based on. You know, well, it is the best thing to do is to make as much money as possible, and the best thing to do is to do offshore.
Yeah,
because tax is immoral. They see it in that way.
Absolutely, yeah. And that brings us back, I think, to the issue we were kicking around a little earlier. You know, what is the point? What is the point of ethics? What are the ethical foundations? And ethics is basic. I mean, ethics is only human. It's only a human issue. I'm not saying, so in a sense, ethics is only of concern to humans. I'm not saying that our ethical focus can't be on environmental, on animals, and so on. You know, inanimate objects don't have any ethic. You know, if a volcano goes off, or as a tsunami, for example, you know, you can't blame the weather in an ethical way. You can say, oh, well, this is a great shame, this is a great disaster. You know, if you're religious, you might want to blame God or the gods or whatever, but it's not ethical. You know, if a piano falls on your head, it's not the piano's fault. You know, if a lion eats you, it's not all lion, you know, the lion's not being unethical, it's just obeying instinct. But when human beings do stuff, then we can be judged according to our ethics. So it's very much a human phenomenon. And it is bound, I think it's all bound up with, you know, what do we think a human being is? You know, do we, you know, are human beings. It was easier from a religious point of view because, say, well, human beings are the creatures of God, and they have an immortal soul. And it's like Plato saying, an immortal soul, and so on. So we have a certain value, a certain kind of dignity. You know, God or the gods give us information about kind of how how human beings should be seen. And we shouldn't take their lives, and we shouldn't kind of tyrannize them, and that all kind of makes sense. Well, now we're saying, well, what is a human being? Are we, you know, are we animals? If we're animals, then, you know, we could take a utilitarian or perhaps a behaviorist view and slap us over the nose with a rolled up newspaper when we do bad things, and give us a treat when we do the things that will contribute to society. It doesn't necessarily be, you know, good things in any objective ethical sense. It's just, you know, if we are contributing to society and making people and, you know, making society happy, then we get a treat. If you're not making society happy, you get a whack over the nose, kick in the ass. Is that what we are? Or are we more than that? Are there tacit dimensions to the human being such that we can genuinely say, you can't do that to me because I have some kind of innate value? You can't do that. And we've had the whole, you know, the kind of Black Lives Matters kind of campaign. There's been lots of kind of, you know, debates and stuff about that, and you've got, you know, various wags coming along and saying, all lives matter, you know, yeah, okay, yeah, or no lives matter or whatever. And it's I mean, although a lot of these things are said flippantly, why do lives matter? And you and I would agree that they matter, but this is the kind of the heart of the ethical concern. Unless we can kind of genuinely sit down and say why they matter, it's very difficult to build an ethic. Because somebody turned up to me and said, "Well, they don't matter. Doesn't matter. If I'm going to just piss over, you know, if I'm going to fuck over these people over there, then, you know, why not?" And you kind of say, "Well, yeah, because you shouldn't." You say, "But why?" you know, surely, the whole of human existence is to do with, you know, how many toys you end up with at the end. Whoever has the most toys at the end wins. Mm.
I think that is a really tough one, actually, and it's making my mind race. So I'm clinging to the things that I think are important and go back to. So, you know, there are I think you said before we have a dignity. I think, is it Kant as well says this? So we have a dignity. What does that mean? So I must go back to Wittgenstein. It's language, isn't it? Language, and we share this common ability, which is kind of you know, it's a communal thing. It's an ability to communicate our thoughts and our feelings and our values. So this is where this is the base of all this ideas. So every human being that can communicate and have language has access to these ideas. I guess that is, in some way, you could say, is objectively worth something.
Yes,
worth, I mean, it's keeping. Not, yeah,
absolutely. I don't think it's any surprise that, I mean, we talked about B.F. Skinner as, you know, as one of the kind of the architects of behaviorism, that, you know, human beings are basically animals, and, you know, we can condition them to behave in whatever way we want. So once we decide what kind of society we want, we can train human beings. We do that. I mean, we have a very behaviorist society. Behaviorist and as you said, to some extent utilitarian, where it's kind of, okay, what do we want in society, right down to kind of, you know, education or kind of whatever. It's kind of, well, once we know what we want, we will train people in this way, we will reward them for doing this, and we'll punish them, or, you know, for doing that. And, you know, Skinner's most famous book is called Beyond Freedom and Dignity, and it's just kind of, if we scrap the whole idea, which is largely kind of, you know, Greek philosophically based and kind of religiously based, we scrap the idea that human beings have any kind of freedom or any dignity, and get shot of those kind of archaic terms, then, you know, what are we left with? Well, we're left with just, you know, instinctual creatures. And, you know, each society, I mean, this is what, I mean, people like H.G. Wells and so on, they said something, I mean, he had, I think, J.M. Barrie as well, the kind of the guy who came up with Peter Pan, you know, all had this view, along with I think along with Bentham, that that the idea of human rights, you know, makes no sense, because while the world is fragmented, while the world is fragmented into different countries, it is a nonsense to say, well, in this country we have these rights, but if you step, you know, a couple of yards over there, then human beings don't have those rights. There's a different understanding of what human beings are in this country. So we could behave in a different way, and that's perfectly legitimate. It's cultural or it's political. And if you move, you know, a couple of hundred miles the other direction, an entirely different system. So we're in a world where we have this kind of, you know, moving conveyor belt of attitudes towards human beings. It makes no sense to talk about human rights in an absolute sense. Where do you start? That would only work once we have a kind of a unified world where we can then sit down and say, okay, what are the rights of humanity? And then we can establish those. And it's like people kind of fleeing, crossing the border on a continent and say, oh, okay, you know, I'm a wanted criminal on this side of the line, but if I step on that side of the line, I'm not. And that's for people like I think like Bentham and people like Wells and so on, that just made a nonsense of any sense of a universal. I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether that's true. I mean, I kind of like to feel that there's a right way and a wrong way of doing things, but I'm not sure I could justify it anymore.